morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for a half hour each weekday to take your calls and deal with the questions you may raise about the Bible or about the Christian faith. Or if you have a difference of opinion and wish to balance comment, feel free to do that. The number is 1-800-227-5278, and you can be on the program today. That's 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Tim, calling from San Diego, California. Tim, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How you doing, sir?
Great, thanks.
You know, there's a verse in the Bible where the Pharisees accused Jesus of being a drunkard and a winebibber. And there was another verse where Jesus says the Son of Man came eating and drinking. My question to you is, do you believe Jesus drank alcoholic beverages, or what do you think?
Yeah, he drank wine. Everybody drank wine. You really couldn't drink the water without adding wine in the ancient world. The water was dangerous. So all people in the Mediterranean world added wine to their water. And so when they drank at any table, there was wine at the table. And they mixed it with their water for safety reasons, for sanitary reasons. It had to be alcoholic wine because it wouldn't do any good otherwise. You can't put grape juice in water and have it kill the microbes, you know. So, of course, it was alcoholic wine. We know that the people of Israel, as well as the people of Rome and Greece and other Mediterranean lands, always had wine at the table. So, there's reason to believe that. Now, there were, of course, people who wished to get drunk on wine. They'd have to drink it more, like straight, without mixing it to do that. And from time to time, the Bible actually mentions wine that is unmixed, as if that's, you know, strong drink. Drinking wine usually meant drinking one part wine with maybe three or four parts water mixed in. That's what drinking wine usually was in the Middle East. But sometimes in the Bible, on occasion, you'll find the term unmixed, wine unmixed mentioned, which would be, of course, straight wine. And people would drink it that way if they wanted to get drunk. I'm sure Jesus didn't do that. He was not a drunkard.
You know, I heard one preacher say that as the Messiah, Jesus would have taken the Nazarite vow, which means he would not have drank wine. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, you have to disagree with that. Jesus was not a Nazarite, and that's the point he made in the passage you're referring to, which is Matthew 11, that John the Baptist, in John 11, 18 and 19, Matthew 11, 18 and 19 says, John came neither eating nor drinking wine, and they say he has a demon. Now, John was a Nazarite. But the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look, a gluttonous man and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. So he's saying that he and John had quite the opposite approach. John was, in fact, a Nazarite, and he didn't drink any wine, which was an unusual thing for a person. You'd take a special vow of abstinence if you were a Nazarite. Jesus didn't take that vow. He took communion, for example, with his disciples. He passed around a cup that had wine in it. Even if it was grape juice, he couldn't drink it if he was a Nazarite, because a Nazarite couldn't drink anything that was a product of the grapevine, grape juice or wine, and they couldn't eat grapes or raisins. That was just part of the Nazarite vow, according to Numbers chapter 6. So Jesus clearly was not a Nazarite.
Thank you.
He was a Nazarene. Yeah, he was a Nazarene, and sometimes people get those two things mixed up. A Nazarite is a person who has a Nazarite vow. A Nazarene is just somebody from the town of Nazareth.
Thank you.
All right, thank you so much for your call. God bless. All right, you're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we do have a couple of lines open. We have one line that's a caller is on there, but I don't see any name for that caller yet, so I can't take the call. So there's a couple of lines open, at least. If you want to reach me, the number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278, and you can get right through. We're going to talk next to David from Beaumont, California. David, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. My question for you today is in regards to 1 John chapter 3, verse 9, and it reads, whosoever is born of God doth not commit sin, for his seed remaineth in him, and he cannot sin, because he is born of God. My question was specifically in regard to where it says he cannot sin. What is your take on that, on that particular part of that verse?
Right. Well, the verb sin in these verses is referring to a continuous practice rather than a single act. To say that a Christian could not commit an act of sin would be actually quite foolish, and John himself denies this when he says in the same book, in chapter 2, he says, "My little children, I write these things to you so that you will not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous." So he knows that his readers might sin, and if they do, they have an advocate with the Father, but he's writing to them to encourage them not to sin. Now, if it was absolutely impossible for a Christian to sin, he wouldn't have to urge them not to do so. It's clearly possible to sin. So what is being said in these, there's a number of passages in 1 John where it says that believers don't sin. And in those passages, it is saying that believers don't practice sin or they don't live in sin. We have, for example, in chapter, just two verses earlier, he says, "Little children, let no one deceive you. He who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous. He who sins is of the devil." Now, sins here is in contrast with practicing righteousness, so it's talking about practicing sin. There are lifestyles of sin, and there are lifestyles of righteousness. A person who is born of God cannot live a lifestyle of sin. They can stumble. You know, the Apostle James said, "In many things we all stumble." And so James acknowledges that Christians do stumble, and when they stumble, they do the wrong thing. That means sin. And John says the same thing. John, in the first chapter, says if anyone says he is without sin, he's a liar. And he says, I'm writing to you so that you won't sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father. So John is very realistic. What he's saying is if you're born again, you have a new heart. You have a new direction.
Right.
You have. It's impossible for you to live like you did before. You can't just continue living in sin like you did before. Your heart won't let you. The Holy Spirit in you won't let you. The seed of God that is in you won't let you. You can't do that.
Do you think it's at all possible in regard to that verse that in 1 John 3:9? Do you think it's at all possible that John might be saying, because our sin, past, present, and future, when we come to faith, repent and come to faith in Jesus Christ, our sin, past, present, and future, is forgiven or paid for by Christ himself on the cross, that in God's eyes, it's as if we cannot sin because we were covered by Jesus' payment on the cross. Might he be saying that at all?
Well, I know people who would see it that way, but I don't think that's how it reads naturally because, like I said, in the previous verses, he's contrasting two ways of life. He's the way of living, of practicing righteousness, and the way of sinning. So he says in verse 7, whoever practices righteousness is a righteous person. He's a Christian. He's born again. He's imputed righteous by Christ, but that shows in his righteous conduct. He's practicing something. Then it says, by contrast, he who sins is of the devil. So he... And then he says, if you've been born of God, you can't do that. So I don't think that's the natural way to see it. I do believe, of course, that the believer has, God's grace given to them to cover sin. But that doesn't mean that we never do commit sin. We sometimes do commit sin, but that's why we need forgiveness.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I appreciate your answer. That's a good answer. I appreciate it very much. Thank you for your ministry, and thank you very much for your answer.
All right, David. Thanks for your call. Let's talk next to Ron from Los Angeles. Ron, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. In Romans 14:14, if Jesus and Paul say that nothing you consume could defile you, then why were three of the four laws given to the Gentile converts pertaining to things that you can't be consumed? I'm talking about Acts 15:29.
Yes, I know.
Shouldn't eat anything from meat offered to idols, from blood, from things strangled. Well, if nothing can defile you, why have those rules?
Because it can defile your neighbor. And that's the concern that James expresses there. And it's also the concern that Paul expresses in First Corinthians chapter 8. James and Paul are both on the same page about this. James is the one who wrote the decree in Acts 15. That's why I mentioned him. Now, Paul, of course, has the same concern. If you read 1 Corinthians chapters 8 through 10 or Romans chapter 14 and 15, you'll find that what Paul's concerned about is that there is the possibility that if you eat meat sacrificed to idols, you will stumble somebody else. Paul believes that there's nothing intrinsically wrong with eating meat sacrificed to idols, but he does believe it's inadvisable if you are in a context where persons who see you doing it may be encouraged to maybe lapse back into idolatry because they associate
with idolatry. If it won't defile you, how is it going to defile your neighbor?
Well, Paul explains that. Paul says, if you eat meat sacrificed to idols, you may have a conscience that realizes that there's nothing to that. And Paul says, an idol is nothing at all. And you may know that, but he says, but not all men know that. And if people say, okay, he eats meat sacrificed to idols, and he's a Christian, so I can too. But to them, they came out of a pagan background. Eating meat sacrificed to idols to them is associated with worshiping pagan gods. And
what about the one from blood?
Okay, well, let me explain what I believe is going on in the Jerusalem Council and its decree there in Acts 15. James and the apostles and the elders of Jerusalem gathered to decide whether the Gentile believers should be circumcised and keep the Jewish ceremonial law. The answer was no, they don't have to do that, but they requested that the Gentiles would abstain from certain things because, it says, Moses has those who have taught him in the synagogues for many generations in every land or in every city. Now, what he's saying is the Gentile converts might end up doing some things that offend the Jewish sensitivities of their Jewish neighbors in every city who for generations have been taught certain things and have certain sensitivities from their synagogue influence. Now, what Paul and James are both concerned about is that although you might have liberty in what you eat may offend or stumble somebody else. Now, in the case of James, what I believe his concern was that James, who had a ministry to the circumcision, was concerned that the Gentile Christians should not alienate unsaved Jews from the gospel by doing things that are obnoxious in the sight of the Jews. If the Jewish people in Corinth or in Rome or in some other pagan city, if the Jewish people saw the Christians there eating blood, this would be extremely offensive to the Jews. And if they said, well, if this is what Christianity is, I don't want anything to do with it. So what Paul and James are concerned about is that the Gentiles' liberty, if expressed insensitively, might turn off those who, like Jews, who have sensitivities about those things. You know, when you read about the things that are forbidden at the Jerusalem Council, there are four things. One, of course, is fornication, and the other three all have to do with what you eat. One of them is blood, one is meat sacrificed to idols, and one is things strangled. Of those three things, only one is forbidden in the law. The eating of blood is forbidden in the law. There is nothing in the law of Moses that says you can't eat meat that's sacrificed to idols. And there's nothing in the law that says you can't eat animals that are strangled. But they were things that the Jews had traditional sensitivities about. And if the Gentiles, who were Christians, continued to eat things like that, which Gentiles did, typically, it would make the Jews look upon the Gentile Christians as if they were barbarians and, offensive to them. And it would make Christianity look bad to them.
Everything that I've ever read about Paul leads me to believe that the last thing he would be worried about would be the sensitivities of the Jews.
Well, then you haven't read enough about Paul, because he explains his policy in 1 Corinthians 9 this very way. He says,
but he talks out of
although
both
I am free from all
mouth,
men.
That's the problem.
No, he does not. No, he does not. Here's what
absolutely
he does.
Absolutely, he does.
You can call this talking out of both sides of his mouth. But here's what he says. In 1 Corinthians 9:19, he says, for though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more. To the Jews, I became as a Jew, that I might win the Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, he means Gentiles, I become as one without law, not being without law toward God, but under the law toward Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as the weak, that I might win the weak, etc., etc. Now, he says, I do all this for the gospel's sake, that I might be a partaker of it with you. So he's not speaking out of both sides of his mouth. He's saying, I have liberty to keep the law or not keep the law, because I'm not under the law.
It's, but he says, in pretense or in truth. He said, whether in pretense or in truth, if I preach the gospel. That's deception.
Wait, where did he say in pretense or in truth?
That's a direct quote from the New Testament.
Tell me where.
Whether I preach the gospel in pretense or truth, as long as I win. He's saying it's okay to pretend you're this, you're that, as long as the end is okay. That's not okay.
Okay, I'm not clear what verse you're referring to. I'm not sure what verse you're referring to. Where does Paul talk about pretense?
You know the Bible, you must know that verse.
Well, that's the thing. I do know the Bible, and I don't know that verse. So I'm just wondering. Now, there are verses that I could be forgetting, but I just don't know where the verse is.
Paul completely does this. I mean, look what he said about himself. I'm a Pharisee.
I just read you what he said about himself. Paul said what his policy was, okay? He said his policy was to avoid doing things unnecessarily offensive to people so he could reach them. Now, if you want to call that pretense, that's fine. It's like if I believe in drinking wine, but I want to go and be a missionary to Muslims, and Muslims don't believe in drinking wine. So if I say, okay, I'm not going to drink any wine among the Muslims, am I being a fake, or am I simply being sensitive, not wanting to offend them? I mean, I guess you could see it either way. If you want to see that as hypocrisy, you may do so, although Paul's not being a hypocrite. He explains his policy very plainly. He writes it out and says, this is what I do. This is my policy. I don't really see how that would be a problem. If I was in a Muslim land and I told the Muslims, you know, as a Christian, I have no problem drinking wine, but since I'm with you, I won't drink it because I don't want to offend you. Now, that would be similar to what Paul is saying here. I don't really see how that would be hypocritical. It's simply being sensitive. And, I mean, obviously, I can't make you agree with me, and nor do I feel like I need to, but I certainly am seeing it differently than you are.
Well, you know something? Paul speaks throughout the New Testament in two different ways. He says one thing, and then he says another thing. Okay?
Well,
I'll give you an example. Can I give you one example?
Okay.
May I?
Sure.
Paul says, I'm a Pharisee of Pharisees. Who was Paul working for on the road to Damascus? He was a policeman for the high priest. That was a Sadducee. And if you know anything about the people of that time, a Sadducee would never be working for the Pharisees. And Gamaliel, who he claims he was a student of, would never have anything to do with people who kill Christians. You see his dealings with Peter alone. He didn't want to kill any Christians.
Gamaliel had a much more lenient position toward them than the others on the high priesthood. That doesn't mean that Paul shared the disposition of Gamaliel. You know, to say that a Pharisee wouldn't work for the high priest is silly, because actually the high priest was the president of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was a mixed group. It was primarily made up of Sadducees, but Pharisees were up on it too. Gamaliel was a Pharisee. He was a leading member of the Sanhedrin. So was Joseph of Arimathea. So you've got Pharisees and Sadducees sitting together, just like in our Senate we have Republicans and Democrats. And to say that if the majority leader of the Senate is a Republican, that there's no Democratic senator that would ever, you know, do some kind of business for the Senate would be, well, I just think an unreasonable thing to suggest. Anyway, you know, we've talked a while. I've got other calls waiting, but I only have about a few minutes left. But I hear your complaint, and you've registered it. Thank you so much. Let's talk to Viola from Monrovia, California. Viola, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi. My question is, in Genesis chapter 6, in verse 2 and in verse 4, it talks about the sons of God saw the daughters of men. Who are the sons of God? Are those angels?
We don't know who they were. They could have been angels, but there's also the view that they were humans. The Bible doesn't really tell us. The term sons of God is used of people in a number of places in the Bible, but it is also used in a few places in the Bible where it seems like it could be angels. In the book of Job, chapters 1 and 2, and later in Job also, there's three times the sons of God are mentioned. And in those contexts, many people believe it's referring to angels, and it could well be. And if it is, then we'd have to say sometimes the term sons of God in the Bible means godly people. And sometimes in the Bible it means angels. Genesis 6 does not tell us which it is. There are many people who believe it is angels that are referred to there. And there are others who believe it is men. I'm not really sure why it would be important for us to know. Of course, our curiosity is piqued when we read it. But I'm not sure what difference it would make in our Christian lives if it turned out one way or the other.
Oh, but isn't it important because in Genesis 6:4 it says there were giants on the earth in those days?
Well, I mean, is important to my Christian life to know whether it was angels or men?
Yes.
How would my Christian life be affected?
I think because it would be in reference to Ephesians chapter 6, in that we fight not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers.
Right.
And yeah.
So are you suggesting that demons might make a habit of having relations with women, so women need to learn spiritual warfare to fight them off, as per Ephesians 6? Is that your suggestion?
That women? No, that all Christians would have a better understanding.
Okay, well,
so
maybe...
So I was just curious, in Genesis...
Okay, I would say if it is important, if it is important, I think God would tell us. And he hasn't told us that it was angels. And I don't really know why it would make a difference. I mean, we do have to fight off demonic powers, of course. We are in a spiritual warfare. But,
okay, well, I was wondering regarding, like, the Hebrew translation of sons of God. Is that how it would be translated, do you know?
It's B'nai Elohim. It's in the Hebrew, it's B'nai Elohim, and the best translation is sons of God. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay, thank you kindly.
Okay, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Bye now. Okay, Ruth from Los Angeles, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Yes, I've always wondered why the woman at the well recognized or called Jesus a Jew. Was it his speech?
Right, when he said, could I have a drink of water from your pot, she said, well, you're a Jew. Why would you ask me, a Samaritan, for that? There's a number of possibilities. One is that Jesus was wearing the traditional Jewish garment, which had a blue border around the hem. The Old Testament law told the Jews that they must wear a blue hem around the border of their garment. Whether all of them did so or not, I don't know. But Jesus may have and probably did. And therefore, she might have recognized that. It'd be like a specific religious uniform of the Jews. It's also possible that he was clearly Jewish by his appearance, by his accent. There might be any number of ways that she could have known him to be a Jew. There's people you meet today that you have a pretty good chance of guessing correctly that they're Jewish just from, appearance. And not necessarily to be stereotypical, but there are people who, you would guess pretty accurately that they're Jewish by meeting them. But Jesus may have been recognized by his clothing.
I often wondered. I know that when Peter had denied Christ, the maiden said, "Your speech betrayeth you." And since he was a Galilean, I didn't know whether that there was some accent or something that he might have had.
It's not impossible. Yeah, Peter clearly had a Galilean accent, and Jesus probably did too. Although Galilean wouldn't necessarily be the same thing as Jewish, because Galilee was a region where there were more Gentiles than Jews living, but it is possible that Galilean Jews had a specific accent to them.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it.
Okay, I appreciate your call, Ruth.
Thank you.
Bye now. A caller called in to help us out because one of our earlier callers, Ron, said that Paul preached the gospel in pretense. I said I didn't know of any case where Paul said that, and he said it's in the New Testament. I thought of this passage in Philippians, but it doesn't say that, so I didn't bring it up. But a caller did bring it up, and for those of you who are curious, in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 18, Paul talks about other people who preach the gospel in pretense. He doesn't say that he does. He said in Philippians 1, verses 14, he says, most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some from goodwill. So he said some people preach the gospel for good motives and some not for good motives. He says the former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my chains, but the latter out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. So he concludes this paragraph saying, what then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached, and in this I rejoice, yes, and I will rejoice. So Paul is saying that he rejoices that the message of Christ is getting out there, even though some people are doing it for the wrong motives, even if they're pretending to have good motives, but they don't. He's not happy about their motives. He's not happy about hypocrisy, but he's glad at least that the gospel is getting out. So Paul does not, I'm pretty sure that, you know, when Ron mentioned that Paul talked about preaching the gospel in pretense, that he had this verse in mind, but since Paul is not here talking about himself preaching the gospel in pretense, I felt it was not the verse. I thought he must be thinking of something else. But, Paul said that there are people who preach the gospel in pretense. He said those people add affliction to his chains. He grieves at their motivations, but he rejoices nonetheless that even if they're preaching out of pretense, the gospel's going out. So that's a far cry from Paul saying that he preaches in pretense. He doesn't approve of those motives. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. Those of you who live in or near Temecula need to know that I'll be speaking in Temecula this Saturday night, and I'm going to be talking about the subject I spoke about in Las Vegas last week, toward a radically Christian counterculture. There's information about that at the website, thenarrowpath.com. We are a listener-supported ministry. We do need support to stay on the air. You can find out more about that at the website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk again tomorrow. God bless.